Call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It's 2:04. Apologies to those who have been online. We had a caucus that took us over time. My apologies. We have Senator Wilkowski, Senator Costello, Senator Schauer, myself, Senator Coghill, Chair. My expectation is to have Senator Kelly here shortly. Two things on our list today, seeing how we have a little tighter timeline. We have some appointees that we want to go ahead and have interviewed, and then we'll pass them along to the full body. And then we'll bring up Senate Bill 150 as promised, and my guess is that's probably going to dominate the meeting today. So anything before we get started, ladies and gentlemen? All right, let's go ahead and have Valerie Davison come forward. Valerie Davison is appointee to Lieutenant Governor's spot. She's the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. And Valerie, welcome to our committee. And put yourself on the record. Give us kind of how you feel about this, where you're at on this, what you expect to do, and thank you for taking the nomination. Give us your testimony, please.
Hoyana, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nuhagala Kamisa Maganan Valerie Davidson, and it's my honor and privilege to be nominated by Governor Walker as Lieutenant Governor's successor. For those in the viewing audience who may know or may not know, when this announcement was read on the Senate and the House floor, I had a lot of concerned calls from folks in the Department of Health and Social Services and concerned calls from folks in the Lieutenant Governor's who are fans of Lieutenant Governor, who said, oh my gosh, is there a change? Are you moving anywhere? And I rest assured everyone, no, I'm not going anywhere, and neither is the Lieutenant Governor. This is a statutory requirement that every governor is required to appoint a Lieutenant Governor successor. It's really a matter of hoping for the best and planning for the worst, that if something should happen, that the Lieutenant Governor's successor would assume the role of Lieutenant Governor should something happen. As I told the Governor and Lieutenant Governor when they asked me to do this, I said, well, to tell you the truth, my family and I pray for each of you every day, and we will double down on our efforts because, again, I really enjoy working with them every day. Did you want me to talk a little bit about where I'm from and those kinds of things, or?
Briefly, and then what you understand of the role of the Lieutenant Governor.
Sure. So in a nutshell, I was born and raised in Bethel and Aniak, when I was 12, my dad got a civilian job at Eielson Air Force Base, and we moved to Salcha. And I went to junior high and high school at Eielson Air Force Base, which my mother called the United States of America. And so it was quite a change going from a community of about 400 people to a very large junior high and high school by my standards. I think there were four Alaska Native students in that school, my brothers, my sister, and me. And so it was quite a big cultural difference. And we were definitely quiet, kind of shy, Yupik kids. And my mother's rule was there's no such thing as can't. And if things are hard, you work harder to make it possible. Because the expectation was that you will do well and you will do well in school. After I finished high school, I started school at UAF, and then in my junior year, I had the opportunity to serve as an intern through the University of Alaska's intern program, where I served. I worked for Senator John Binkley, who was then co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. I was then hired on staff, so I worked for him full-time during the day for 3 years while I went to school full-time at night. When I was done with that, I finished my degree. I finished, graduated from school at University of Alaska Southeast with a degree in education. I'm actually an early childhood teacher by training. I taught school for a few years, and then I went to graduate school at the University of New Mexico, which I found to be very hot. A typical Alaska kid who travels outside for school, I was always the last flight in to there and the first flight out. Came home every spring break, every Christmas break, and worked hard in the summer so that I could pay my out-of-state tuition. And when I was done, I moved back to Alaska, again, first flight out, and I worked for a year for Jalista Corporation, which is my regional corporation, for a year. And then I began my career in tribal health. I worked for about 7 years for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel, and about 8 years at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium before taking on the role of Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. In terms of this appointment, as I mentioned before, this is a contingency plan just in case, but the Lieutenant Governor's responsibilities are pretty clear. The biggest responsibility is to really supervise the Director of the Division of Elections, who's responsible for ensuring fair election outcomes and ensuring that every Alaskan has the opportunity to vote. Gearing up for election season, they hire almost 3,000 employees to ensure that a fair election process. The Lieutenant Governor's office also publishes the regulations, publishes the online public notice system, commissions Alaska's notaries public, and also is sometimes called upon to authenticate state official signatures on official documents for foreign countries. And then I think it's not a statutory requirement, but one thing they do and have for many, many years is to publish the small Alaska constitution.
Questions? Senator Wilkowski, you have a question?
Throw a question or two out there, I guess. Normally, our lieutenant governors are exposed to 5 months or more of debates and processes. So just curious, what are your thoughts on how we can increase voter turnout in the state of Alaska? We had an election in Anchorage last night, and it was 25% turnout. I know it's the municipal level, but on the state level, it's maybe 50%, maybe a little bit higher in a good year. Any thoughts? Because that's somewhat related to the role of Lieutenant Governor on that. And then I guess the second question, and just on maybe a broader scale, what I'm just curious, some of your thoughts on, because you could potentially be governor. just curious on some of your thoughts on some of the bigger issues that are facing us, crime. And I don't want to take up a huge amount of time, but the budget obviously is a big one. I mean, just some of your general thoughts on, are we headed in the right direction? How you might propose to resolve some of those real thorny issues we're facing?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. So I think one of the things that Alaska and other states are really struggling with is as young people come of age, I'm not so sure that they're necessarily seizing the opportunity to be a voter. And I think we could probably, as a state, and Alaska's no different than any other state, of really encouraging young people about the power of a vote and the opportunity. And I think we could probably do more of that as a state. But I think sometimes, I think one of the challenges that we have is, you know, some folks may think, well, that's the responsibility of the Director of the Division of Elections or the responsibility of the Lieutenant Governor, but really, it should be every Alaskan's responsibility to encourage young people who are coming up of their right and their responsibility to vote. And I think once we do that, I think we'll have much better voter participation, because I think we sometimes do ourselves a disservice by having it, the perception being that it's one person or one organization or one agency's responsibility to do that. And I think the more we can encourage young people to do that on a personal level, the better off we are. I know I had friends years ago as a young person who didn't vote, and I was shocked and a little bit horrified. And sometimes they would tell me that, well, I'm not happy about such and such. And I would say, well, did you vote? You know, you really should. And they are now super voters. And so a part of it is just making sure that people know what's at stake, and that we encourage people to participate in the process. So in terms of where we are in terms of priorities, and again, Lieutenant Governor's successor is a contingency plan, and they're both in great health, thank goodness. But I will say that Alaska is in a tight financial time right now. As you all know, you're dealing with this every single day. One of the things that I have really appreciated about Alaska and the kind of place that Alaska is that we have faced tough decisions before. I mean, we had challenging times in the 80s. And we sometimes come from a place where we are politically very different. But when tough decisions need to be made and people have the opportunity to be heard, we generally arrive at really good places and at really good decisions. I consider myself to be very lucky that I saw one of the best examples of that a few years ago when the legislature passed Senate Bill 74. The Medicaid reform bill was very much a bipartisan effort. Those were really, especially in that first year, I think I could fairly describe those as pretty tough conversations. But people stayed in the room and we worked through those issues and we have a much better outcome. I think it's when sometimes folks feel like they don't have the opportunity to be heard, that I think we run into problems. And so I think Alaska has what it takes. We are the people who are prepared to solve that problem. And I think that the challenge is we have to continue to keep talking to each other to make sure that we can work through those issues. Alaskans are reasonable people. And I think everybody in the state knows that this is a really challenging time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and move along. Appreciate your willingness, some good answers. And now I'm going to ask Quinlan Steiner to come on it. Thank you, Valerie. And what we'll do is we'll bring yours and the other names up for the nomination form before we leave.
All right, Brianna, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
So just to keep people aware, we have Megan McKinnon, who's an appointee to the Human Rights Commission, and Freddie Olinen, I think I got that right, I said that right, who's an appointee to the Violent Crimes Compensation, no, I'm sorry, also the appointee to the State Commission on Human Rights. Mr. Steiner. You have been appointed to be the public defender for Alaska. That's something that you're not unfamiliar with. Give us a little bit of that history, testimony, and if you're willing to do this again.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. This will be my fourth term, if I'm confirmed. I've just completed my third four-year term. I began my legal career as a public defender. In fact, went to law school for the purpose of becoming a public defender. I had been pursuing a career in business and met some public defenders who were the first people I'd met who actually loved their job completely and every day, and it got me inspired, and I ended up going to law school for that purpose. Volunteered before going to law school at the Public Defender Agency and worked as a legal intern in law school, and was hired right afterwards. As I said, this is would be my fourth term. As public defender, I came on with some initial plans to increase, you know, the effectiveness of the agency in terms of our recruiting and our structure and supervision, which was at the time flatter than I thought was appropriate. So we boosted our recruiting efforts and our supervision efforts to make sure that cases were handled appropriately, efficiently, and effectively. And more recently, I've shifted towards efforts to exploit technologies for efficiencies and collaborative opportunities with the Department of Law and other agencies to make sure that things are handled as efficiently and effectively as possible. And those are things that we're pursuing. Also, current initiative that I'm working on that I think and hope will have a long-term benefit to the state is a holistic defense initiative, which is through grants and volunteers. We are seeking to help clients get hooked up with services and address other barriers that are a little bit outside of their specific legal cases to help them avoid future contacts with the criminal justice system. Through the grant funding that we have, we're seeking to get some data to show that's not only effective but cost-effective for the state in terms of clients reduce or accessing emergency service at lower rates and having fewer contacts with the criminal justice system. Anecdotally, we've had positive success and had great success, but I'm really looking forward to getting the data to show that those kinds of initiatives can have a long-term impact on the agency's clients. And happy to answer any questions.
You're willing to serve again?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bilikowski?
Yeah, thank you. Do you believe that we have enough public defenders in the state of Alaska?
Not at this time, no. I think from the calculations based upon the standards set by the American Bar Association and some recent studies that were conducted in other states and similar study done by Alaska's Legislative Audit Division back in 1998, to get the agency to an area where we're not required ethically to work in excess of 90 hours, we need a substantial increase. You know, the studies from out of state, you know, they're not this state and they're not specific, and the Alaska Legislative Audit is old and ought to be updated, but we are presently over our maximum caseload. And because of the increases that we've seen this year, and they're dramatic increases that we're projecting for this year, we expect to go significantly over. And those numbers need to come down, in my opinion.
Senator Wilkowski.
So is the state of Alaska at risk of violating the Constitution by not having enough public defenders?
If the projections that I've calculated for this year and next year are materialized without additional resources, then yes. We would be in a situation where we would be required to attempt to refuse appointments. There's an ethical principle that requires lawyers not to accept work that they can't handle competently. And if we have too many cases to do the required tasks, we would be forced into a situation where we would attempt to refuse. It wouldn't be clear what the courts would do. They could agree with us, allow us out of those cases, and the state would likely be required then to engage private lawyers at a much higher cost. Or the courts could conclude that we need to deal with these cases with the budget that we have, and the consequences of that would be substantial increases in delays and costs and that are associated with the errors that would occur and having insufficient time to get the work done.
So, Mr. Steiner, is that a function of budget only, or is it a function of being able to get the personnel to do the work?
It's largely a function of budget at this time. I've made budget requests to both the House and the Senate, and that's in process, which will help alleviate the sort of immediate concern for this year and get us to a point where we're back under that max caseload line, or at least close enough to it that we can address FY19 as that's happening. But it really is largely a question of budget. We're able to recruit through our efforts in recruiting. We have access to very good candidates that are coming out of law school and coming off of clerkships in terms of hiring, because our model is to hire new lawyers, train them, and work them up to where they can handle our high-level cases. There's a need to have many to train the few that are capable of handling the highest and most complex cases.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Senate Bill 91, you were an advocate for that. I think everyone on this committee has heard concerns from many constituents about that, Alaskans about that. In your opinion, is it working? Does it need changes?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, at this point, there's no data that tells us one way or another if the initiatives are achieving the goals that we had expected to see, which is reductions in recidivism. That process will take some time to gather the data and then link it back to the changes. I can tell you that the portions that I've seen in effect are having the changes that we expected to see generally, that things are happening as a result and that they were expected, and that the expectation is that will flow from that will be the reductions in recidivism. But what's key and I think needs to be more robust is the access to the various services that individuals are going to need, be it rehabilitative treatment, drug and alcohol treatment, vocational, educational programs that can really take the initiatives and their benefits and really maximize them for reductions. As far as changes that need to be made, there have been, there was last year, there was a bill where the commission voted for changes that I think smoothed out what I think were some of the initiatives, really got them to be more consistent and smooth. There's a bill that we'll be testifying to this afternoon that I think addresses substantially the concerns raised about out-of-state convictions. I think it's a measured response to those concerns to make sure that every aspect of this is considered and not unexpectedly excluded.
Senator Bilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you said the workload was up significantly for public defenders, and I would presume that's because there's more people being arrested, more people needing public defenders. Would you say that crime has, I mean, is it fair, this is certainly what we're hearing, and the statistics seem to show, would you agree that there's more crime in Alaska, particularly Anchorage, where Senator Costello from? And then, if so, what would you attribute that increase to? Is it because of Senate Bill 91 or because of other, is that a part of the factor, or are there other factors?
Through the chair, crime is up across the state. It started going up several years before SB 91 and criminal justice reform was passed. The data that I've seen does not suggest that criminal justice reform exacerbated that. But it's very limited data, and it's hard to draw any conclusions, and I wouldn't draw any conclusions from what I've seen. In fact, what happened immediately after the passage of SB 91 is most of the crime indicators went down, but that was purely seasonal, except for vehicle theft, which continued to go up. In fact, everything had been trending up, I think back as far as, don't quote me, but it was several years before criminal justice reform that it started back up. It had been going down for years. As to what the contributing factor to that is, there are probably many. I know that we are seeing more cases related to heroin over those same years than we'd seen in the past. Methamphetamines remain an issue. It would be difficult for me to say what the causation was for that, what caused crime to turn around. You know, our caseload and the workload associated with it is, in fact, partly really related to our staffing. Our staffing has been reduced. And so while overall criminal caseloads had come down for a couple of years while our staffing was reduced, the complexity of those cases went up. We had a much higher percentage of high-level, more serious felonies relative to the misdemeanors. So our workload actually went up during that period where our overall caseload declined. And what happened this year, which was so dramatic, is that turned a corner. Our caseload jumped off the chart in the first two quarters of this year, and that was unexpected. Even though the staffing wasn't going down and things were kept more or less even, the jump in cases was unexpected and substantial, and I expect that to continue both for the rest of this year and into next year as if resources are added to increase prosecutions and investigations.
Gwendolyn, thank you for taking the job and being willing to work with us. I've heard the effectiveness of the Public Defender's Office. But I do know that the caseload has been something that has plagued you. And we're grappling with it at a different level, but you're one of the elements in that level. So thank you. No further questions. Thank you very much. We're going to make a motion to pass you along to full body. Thank you for your willingness to serve Alaska. I'm going to go to appointee Megan McKiernan, who is online with under consideration for the State Commission on Human Rights. So, Megan, are you there? Can you hear us? Are you on mute?
Apologies, I was on mute. thank you, I'm here.
Thank you. Put yourself on the record, Megan, and give us your testimony and any experience you have with the Human Rights Commission.
Thank you. Yes, I am Megan McCarran. I'm a physician assistant up in Nome, Alaska, and I have been pleased to be working with the Human Rights Commission for the past 6 months. And I was pleased to be in Juneau last week and get to meet with several of you, and excited about the work that the commission is doing.
And Megan, have you been to some of the meetings? So you said the 6 months. So how many meetings are within that time frame?
Two
meetings. Okay. I understand you've got to deal with a gender identity issue right off the bat. Tell us a little bit about your first look at that issue.
Yes, I did get to deal with that issue right off the bat. And I think from the perspective of the commission, looking at the things, or attempting to look at things from a statutory perspective, and kind of debate through the commission, and I think our decision was kind of, we knew that there was pending legislation and decided to withhold a decision pending that legislation.
Other issues that you found that were new to you, or was that something that you had been involved in prior? On the human
That's
rights
not
issue.
Something that I had been involved in prior. I am involved in a number of issues up here in Nome that dealing with discrimination on multiple fronts, but that is not one that I had particularly been involved in.
Okay. Is there other questions for Megan at this point? Senator Kelly?
Thank you. I just wanted to get clarification on your support of Alaska law on the issues that may come before you, and I just want to make sure that you will support Alaska law regardless of your personal position on issues. Is that the case?
That is the case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Also, Senator Schauer.
Hi, Megan. Just one question. Do you have, what are your thoughts on the human rights record, if you've looked at it, regarding China and its generic oppression of its people as far as their freedoms of speech and other things that have been in the news? Do you have an opinion on that?
If I were to gauge an opinion, I am actually quite familiar with conditions in China, discrimination there, again, based on race, tribal affiliation, gender, gender identity, family status, and particularly disability. And that's definitely a situation of significant concern. Not sure that the Human Rights Commission, we have too much to say about that, except to, you know, we always advocate for improved human rights conditions around the world and for all persons.
Thank you, and I know that I let that question go, but it was a little unfair because we don't get to manage much of what China does, except for how we respond to them economically, usually.
I should have counseled that. I apologize.
Yeah, so, but I think from Senator Schauer's perspective, we do watch who we trade with and how we deal with those issues. But I appreciate your answer on just following the statutory provisions in our law, which I think is important. Other questions at this point? Megan, I just want to personally thank you for being willing to work on what sometimes can be a very difficult commission, because the issues that that individuals can dish up, you get to see some of the kind of the toughest parts of human behavior. And so I appreciate your being willing to take the task on.
Thank you.
And I'm going to release you to the work of your day and go on to Freddie Olin. So that we can conclude our testimony on the commission human, I think, let's see, Freddie is part of the consideration for the State Human Rights Commission as well. Freddie, can you hear us?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is Freddie Owen.
Please give us your history with the commission at this point, your willingness to work on it, and a little bit about your background.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was appointed to the commission in January by Governor Walker, and I participated in the meeting as well with Ms. McKiernan last week in Juneau. I was part of a group that visited several legislative offices having a discussion about the exclusion of nonprofits under the human rights law. It was just an exploratory discussion with the legislative offices, and I definitely have a steep learning curve.
Is there any questions? Senator Costello has a question, Freddie.
Thank you, Freddie. And it looks like you've been interested in serving in this kind of capacity and for the city and borough of Juneau and then move. But I was just looking at your resume, and it says you're a UAF undergraduate student, and I was just curious what you're studying.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, yes, I'm a rural development student through UAF, although I live in Anchorage. And hopefully I'll graduate at some point in 2019.
Thank you, Fred. I was just curious if you were, what you're actually studying, if it's some kind of something related to this issue or if it's something different.
To the chair, Senator Costello, my degree emphasis, it's a Bachelor's of Arts degree. The emphasis is Indigenous Organization Management. It's focused for working for a tribal government or a tribal organization, maybe an Alaska Native corporation.
Great. I wish you the best in completing that degree. Exciting.
Other questions? Freddie, we wish you the best in serving Alaska in this commission. Sounds like you have a good background for it. Welcome to serving in this arena. I see no further questions, so I'll release you to your duties of the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And with that, committee members, I'm going to read the report that we can have read and signed later. In accordance with the Alaska Statute 3905.080, the Judiciary Committee review the following recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Lieutenant Governor's successor, Valerie Davidson. State Commission for Human Rights, Megan McKiernan, Freddie Olin, and then the Public Defender, Quinlan Steiner. Does not reflect an intent of any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during the preceding session. So we'll have this signed up. And thank you very much for participating and being willing to serve. So with that, we're going to go on to the next issue of the day, which I'm hoping that we can – okay. Move right along on. We're going to bring up Senate Bill 150. And my expectation is I want to conclude the meeting with a final vote on this today, if I could all possibly do it. And since we were delayed a half an hour, I'm going to run us into as close to 3:30, if that's what it takes, as possible. Other people have meetings at 3:30, so I'm going to have to take that out at this point. So when last we were talking about it, we actually had talked about some amendments, and there were some questions on just the way the process worked for the pretrial enforcement. What I did was we had to kind of quit in the middle of that conversation, so I do have Jerry Fox, who's still online and available for questions at this point. And on some of the statistics, some of the questions were brought up on some of the statistics for pretrial enforcement. We can have her go through that if you wish, or we can go directly into amendments. I have one that we asked the department to come and speak to, and that was on the five-year look back. I agreed that I would have an amendment ready to do that, and I think we got that on record, right? The conversation on the for and against, which I said I was willing to take up. So unless there's further questions for Jerry Fox or the Department of Law or anything at this point, is it okay to proceed with the amendments? Since I brought up the one, is it all right if I take up the first one to deal with the five-year look back? Let me take a brief at ease while I get that in front of you, and we'll sign this document on the appointees, all right? We'll take a brief at ease. So, Senate Bill 50, we have agreed that we would come forward with the amendments, and the amendment that I was bringing up that we'd agreed about with the department was a five-year look back. Senator Costello?
I move Amendment 1, version Oscar.6, before the committee.
Which deletes the 5 years within the 5 years language on page 5, line 13. We'll call that amendment number one. I'll object if there's any conversation on this one. Everybody's pretty well aware of what it does.
I just want to make a comment.
Okay, make a comment.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate this amendment because it allows the data then to be collected by the department and then become validated data in the future.
Yes. And that was the primary reason that the Department of Law gave me, and it gives them a broader reach than I had originally put in the bill, and they talked me into it. So I'm going to remove my objection. Unless there's any other objection, amendment number one passes. Senator Wilkowski, I'm going to let you bring up the next several amendments, and we'll see how we go with them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's O.3, Oscar.3. I will offer as amendment number 2.
And I'll object. Speak to your amendment, please.
Thank you. What direct your, well, it's a simple five-line amendment, but what, so in Senate Bill 91, there were provisions that were put in place that required the mandatory release for people and set up an assessment tool or mandated that the Department of Corrections set up an assessment tool. And I fundamentally agree with the, I think what the way we were handling bail needed to be fixed. I think it was, there were unfairnesses there. You had people who were being held in jail simply because they couldn't afford to post bail, and I think that's fundamentally unfair. At the same time, I do think it needs to be changed a little bit. I've heard many, many concerns from constituents, from Alaskans, and so what this amendment would do is it deals with low-level misdemeanors, and it deletes the requirement for mandatory release where a person is arrested for a misdemeanor and is deemed to be a moderate risk. So, we've had some discussion about the assessment tool, and we talked quite a bit about that at the last hearing. I guess part of my concern is just I have some real concerns with this pretrial assessment tool that's been set up, and I understand it's going to be changed, but you could have someone who has multiple failure to appear warrants in the last several years, multiple arrests, and still be deemed to be a low risk, and still be deemed, quite frankly, to be multiple arrests and convictions, and failure to appear and be considered moderate. So what this does is it changes the requirement for judges to mandatorily release people who are at moderate risk of appearing in court. And I think that's a reasonable solution. I think, and by the way, this does not take away, this does not require a judge to keep somebody locked up in jail. Here's what it requires. It requires a judge, when someone doesn't have mandatory release, they're still subject, the judicial officer must find on the record that there is clear and convincing evidence that no non-monetary conditions of release in combination with the release of the person on the person's own recognizance or upon execution of an unsecured bond can reasonably ensure the appearance of the person in court and the safety of the victims, other persons, and the community. So this simply gives the discretion back to the judges. It gives discretion back to the Department of Law, to our prosecutors out there, to say, if you're a moderate risk, if you've scored high enough where you have multiple convictions, multiple arrests, multiple failure to appear possibly, then we're going to leave that to the discretion of a judge. We're not going to say mandatorily you have to let them free. I think that's a reasonable approach. I think if you talk to most prosecutors, they would probably agree with it. If you talk to most judges, they would probably unanimously agree with it. I'm all supportive of giving people second chances, but this is a group of people in this moderate group who have been given multiple chances already. If they've scored high enough to be in the moderate level, they inevitably have multiple arrests, multiple convictions. And so I think this is something that my constituents are frustrated with. I think it's something that Alaskans all across the state are frustrated with, people. And I asked the Department of Law, I asked the Attorney General, are we seeing a situation where people are getting arrested, being released, getting arrested, being released, getting arrested, being released? And they said yes. They testified in front of that committee that that is absolutely what is happening right now. I don't know how often it's happening, but they testified it's happening. I'm hearing from constituents that it's happening. And this is simply an effort to give a little bit of discretion back to the judges to say, if you're a moderate risk, I'm not going to let you go unless you post some bail to ensure that you're going to come back to the court. So I think it's a reasonable approach to this, Mr. Chairman. Maybe when the Department of Corrections has their act together and has an assessment tool that is a little bit more reliable, works a little bit better, maybe we can come back and revisit some changes. But until that happens, I think this needs to be fixed.
Yeah. And I'm going to maintain my objection. I think you're mixing several things together here. First of all, if somebody violates their condition of release based on mandatory recognizance, they would automatically be kicked out of the mandatory release provision. The scoring would be high enough if they've had multiple failures before, failure to appear. So I think that the tool is working well, and it certainly may very well need to be refined. But I think what you're saying is giving the impression that there's no supervision under the mandatory release provision. That's just not true. There is supervision, and if they fail that supervision, then they are not in the mandatory ever again. So that's one way to hold people accountable. And the other thing I would say is probably for the first time, we actually are catching people that are failing to appear, whereas prior to this pretrial, that just wasn't the case. So it was a rare example of somebody being caught on their conditions of release. So I can have that corroborated from the department if you wish, but I'll maintain my objection. Is there other comment? Then I'll call for the vote.
Senator Costello.
Yes.
Senator Schauer.
Yes.
Senator Willikowski.
Yes.
Senator Kelly.
No.
Senator Coghill.
No.
Three yeas, two nays.
For adjournment.